No ancient general can compete with Judah's legacy. There are no soldiers today fighting in Rome or Greece in the name of Caesar or Alexander, seeing these ancient leaders as their inspiration. But today there are Jews speaking Judah's language, fighting in Judah's land, and merging their fighting and faith as Judah once did, and remembering Judah as they do so. Welcome to 15 Minute Maccabees, Episode 8, Judah's Last Stand. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. With Chanukah coming, the IDF this year, so rightly focused on providing military supplies for its soldiers, also worked to provide another sort of supplies, more spiritual in nature. Lahav Harkov reported that, quote, the IDF logistics department is starting to distribute 100,000 Chanukah menorahs with wax candles, 15,000 menorahs with olive oil candles, 5,000 Jerusalem-style aquariums, so the menorahs stay lit outdoors, hundreds of giant menorahs. End quote. It is a striking reminder of how the story of Judah and the Chanukah he oversaw is marked, commemorated, and celebrated by soldiers today fighting in the very same land thousands of years after Judah lived. It is this that we ponder as we describe Judah's death, remembering how he fell, but also how he lives still. As we saw, Demetrius, the son of the brother of Antiochus IV, seized the Seleucid throne from his first cousin Antiochus V, installed a Hellenist Jew by the name of Alcimus as high priest, and sent his general Nicanor into Judea to defeat Judah, with Nicanor being felled by Judah in battle. Following the moment marked from then on throughout the Second Temple Age, known as the Day of Nicanor, Judah turned from the military to the diplomatic arena. Noting that the Roman Republic had itself successfully fought against the Seleucids, Judah sought an alliance with Rome, which would effectively serve as a recognition by Rome of the rights of Jews to creating a government separate from Seleucid rule. The first book of Maccabees reports that the Romans sent a statement of alliance to Judah, which declared, quote, and concerning the wrongs which King Demetrius is doing to them, we have written to him as follows. Why have you made your yoke heavy upon our friends and allies, the Jews? If now they appeal again for help against you, we will defend their rights and fight you on sea and on land. End quote. Here, one is reminded of the strategy sought by America in its infancy when it fought for independence against a mighty empire. America focused not only on military success, but also on victory in the diplomatic arena. Benjamin Franklin in France sought an alliance with England's enemy and rival. Here, Judah sought an alliance with Rome to deter or defeat the Seleucids' rival power. Meanwhile, Demetrius, undeterred by the death of Nicanor, sent another general, Bacchides, into Judea, seeking not only the defeat of Judah, but the reinstallation of Alcimus as high priest. First Maccabees again, quote, when Demetrius heard that Nicanor and his army had fallen in battle, he sent Bacchides and Alcimus into the land of Judah a second time, and with them the right wing of the army. They went by the road which leads to Gilgal and encamped against Mesaloth in Arbela, and they took it and killed many people. In the first month of the 152nd year, they encamped against Jerusalem. Then they marched off and went to Berea with 20,000 foot soldiers and 2,000 cavalry. Here a stand is made by Judah at Elassa, northwest of Jerusalem, facing off against the Seleucids. But the massive Seleucid army deterred many of his soldiers. Again, Maccabees. Now Judah was encamped in Elassa, and with him were 3,000 picked men. When they saw the huge number of the enemy forces, they were greatly frightened, and many slipped away from the camp, until no more than 800 of them were left. When Judah saw that his army had slipped away and the battle was imminent, he was crushed in spirit, for he had no time to assemble them. He became faint, but he said to those who were left, "Let us rise and go up against our enemies. We may be able to fight them." But they tried to dissuade him, saying, "We are not able. Let us rather save our own lives now, and let us come back with our brethren and fight them. We are too few." But Judah said, "Far be it from us to do such a thing as to flee from them. If our time has come, let us die bravely for our brethren and leave no cause to question our honor." End quote. Judah here seems to sense that he might be defeated. But of course, we know that Judah had been defeated before and that loss in battle was conceivable to him. And if so, the question is obvious. Why did Judah not retreat? Why not wait to a later, more propitious moment to fight? Has not every general found retreat essential at one point? Why did a man with such a brilliant military mind take a stand that he knew may be his last? For the historian Bezalel Bar Kokhba, who wrote a major work on Yehuda HaMaccabee, Judah's actions indicated his concern that fleeing the Seleucid forces would allow for the influence of Alcimus to grow. Here we may recall that Judah's central concern, the issue for which he fought, was the purity of the temple and the perpetuation of Judaism. If that is the case, action may have been deemed essential by Judah in order to advance this end. Bar Kokhba puts it this way, quote, aside from his concern for the well-being of Jews everywhere, cf. His measures after the purification of the temple, he knew that inaction on his part might impair his status as leader of the people and tip the scales gradually in favor of Alcimus and his faction. End quote. Another suggestion can also perhaps be put forward. Walter Russell Mead, in his recent book on the history of America and its focus on the Holy Land, describes the disagreement between Truman and his Secretary of State Marshall regarding American support for the emergence of an independent Israel. Mead argues that for Marshall, it seemed obvious that the nascent Jewish state would be crushed. Marshall, therefore, did not wish to anger the Arab states for the sake of Jewish forces that he believed could not win. Thank goodness, Truman disagreed. And thank goodness, the Jewish forces did indeed win. And Mead notes that Truman's sympathy for an independent Jewish state was ultimately bolstered by the military success of Jewish forces in the run-up to May 1948. Here, Judah, having just brokered diplomatic relations with Rome, perhaps felt that he needed to show Rome that its support was not unwarranted, that the Jewish forces could stand up to the Seleucids. In contrast, the Seleucids themselves sought to deter other alliances that Judah might forge. As Kelly Bell writes, quote, Demetrius feared a Rome-supported Judea might induce another of his inherited enemies, Egypt, to join the alliance and invade his empire through Judea, end quote. One might therefore suggest that Judah felt that standing up to Demetrius here was essential. With that in mind, let us study 1 Maccabees' description of the battle that unfolded. Maccabees reads, Then the army of Bacchides marched out from the camp and took its stand for the encounter. The cavalry was divided into two companies, and the slingers and the archers went ahead of the army, as did all the chief warriors. Bacchides was on the right wing. Flanked by the two companies, the phalanx advanced to the sound of the trumpets, and the men with Judas also blew their trumpets. The earth was shaken by the noise of the armies, and the battle raged from morning till evening. Judas saw that Bacchides and the strength of his army were on the right. Then all the stout-hearted men went with him, and they crushed the right wing, and he pursued them as far as Mount Azotus. When those on the left wing saw that the right wing was crushed, they turned and followed close behind Judah and his men. The battle became desperate, and many on both sides were wounded and fell. Judas also fell, and the rest fled. End quote. Interpreting this passage, the following might be deduced. In facing a much larger force, Judah chose the same strategy that had been utilized in the past, focusing directly on killing Bacchides, the general leading the Seleucid army, so that the enemy would psychologically collapse. This had been achieved against Apollonius and Nicanor, earlier enemies. And it seems this is what Eleazar had attempted in assaulting what he had thought was the elephant of Antiochus V. This strategy, however, was what the Seleucid general Bacchides was expecting. He was waiting for Judah's drive on the right flank where he, Bacchides himself, was, and had set up a trap to surround Judah when that occurred. Writing of the Syrians, Kelly Bell writes, quote, In Bacchides they finally found a leader capable of concocting viable strategy and instilling needed flexibility into Syrian formations. Considering the overpowering numerical advantage the Syrians enjoyed in that April clash, it could be said the Maccabees were drawn into a trap, even if they realized it from the beginning, for they could not afford to allow this pagan multitude to rampage unchecked through Judea. Confronting it when they did, before they had time to assemble sufficient soldiers, was unavoidable and fatal. The best summation of this battle and Judah's fall in 160 BCE comes from Bezalel Bar Kokhba's book, quote, As a leader who attained his status through military achievements, Judas Maccabeus could not allow himself not to be involved in the battle. Since it was clear that sooner or later the Jewish infantry would break under the pressure of the Seleucid heavies, thus bringing the battle to a close, he had to choose between two possibilities. The first, to make a cavalry assault against the vulnerable flanks of the advancing Seleucid phalanx, was rejected, because it would lay the Jews open to a flanking attack by Bacchides' horsemen. The second, to assault the right cavalry wing directly, seemed to have the better chance, in view of the assumption, already proven in battles with Apollonius and Nicanor, that the death of the enemy commander was likely to tip the scales. Having previously spent some time in Judea, Bacchides was doubtless acquainted with Judas Maccabeus' methods, and expected a reaction of that kind. End quote. This was Judah's last stand. His body was retained in the midst of battle by his brethren and buried in Modiin, and his legacy looms so large today. Kelly Bell makes the case from a purely historical perspective for why Judas should be remembered. Quote, For no small reason, Judas was called the hammer. His unparalleled battlefield adaptability, proficiency in exploiting an enemy's mistakes, ability to fight at night, and effective use of terrain, surprise, and espionage made him the bane of succeeding Seleucid commanders. After Judas's death, his brothers Jonathan and Simon eventually achieved the Judean dream of religious and political independence. It was the first time in recorded history that a subject people had won a revolutionary war for religious freedom. Because he fought in just one poorly chronicled war, Kelly Bell continues, Judas Maccabeus has largely been lost among the giant shadows cast by Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, Genghis Khan, Napoleon Bonaparte, Shaka Zulu, and other great conquerors. Unlike them, Judas was a man of noble motives who fought because he had no other choice. Unfettered by outmoded convention, he taught himself and his followers to fight via methods too subtle to be perceived by their powerful but outmoded adversaries. Today's high-tech military strategists would be well-served to study the humble partisan leader of long ago, who wanted nothing more for himself and his people than to be allowed to live and worship in peace. End quote. A contrast to other warriors is instructive, and I would argue that the achievements of Judah go beyond that which Kelly Bell describes. No ancient general can compete with Judah's legacy. There are no soldiers today fighting in Rome or Greece in the name of Caesar or Alexander, seeing these ancient leaders as their inspiration. But today there are Jews speaking Judah's language, fighting in Judah's land, and merging their fighting and faith as Judah once did, and remembering Judah as they do so. And here the symbolism of Chanukah today is so significant. We have seen how Judah's celebration of the first Chanukah was focused on the altar and its dedication. As the temple fell under Rome and the altar of the temple no longer in existence, the rabbis instructed Jews around the world to remember another miracle that occurred during Judah's dedication, the finding of the one pure flask of oil, undefiled by pagans, that lasted much longer than was predicted, and which therefore embodied the biblical faith of the Jews that defies time, as well as the temple for which Judah fought. Remembering this miracle by kindling lamps at the doors of Jewish homes reminded Jews that because Judah's quest was not for his own power or glory, but for the defense of the temple, for the sanctity of Jerusalem, and for the endurance of Judaism, therefore, like the oil itself, the legacy of Judah and the faith for which he fought would last much longer than the worldview of the conquerors of his age, that indeed Judaism would be eternal. Jewish Jerusalem would not disappear from history. The Jewish link to the land of Israel would be eternal. And so it is proven to be. One of the most moving Hanukkah stories from Israel today focused on Ammunition Hill, the site where, during the Six-Day War, so many soldiers fell right before the old city of Jerusalem was liberated. Today, olive oil is manufactured from trees that grow there, and the Jerusalem Post reported how those trees have played a role in the celebration of Chanukah by soldiers this year. Quote, Ammunition Hill, a significant heritage site in Jerusalem, announced the lighting of 90 menorahs with olive oil across various battlefields, including areas within Gaza. This initiative is set to take place during the upcoming Chanukah festival, symbolizing a profound commemoration and a message of peace and triumph. The olive oil, specially extracted from olive trees planted at Ammunition Hill after the Six-Day War, embodies a rich history of valor and victory. These trees stand as living memorials to the fallen soldiers of the war, with 182 olive trees planted by the bereaved families, a statement on behalf of the Ammunition Hill Memorial said. End quote. Thus, the oil from trees growing where Jewish soldiers fought for Jerusalem sanctifies the Chanukah of Jewish forces that fight right now, bringing light in the darkness, joining the memory of those that fought for Jerusalem in the 1960s and those that fought for Jerusalem in the 160s BCE, ensuring that in a very real way, Judah the Maccabee still lives. This is Meir Soloveitchik, wishing you a luminous and meaningful last day of Chanukah, signing off.